Welcome to the presentation on modernisms, and sorry, I kind of hesitated because I had trouble titling this presentation. And the reason being is we've looked at so much modern art at this point, and modern art isn't necessarily like a logical step-by-step chronological evolution. There's a lot of different modern art movements happening at the same time. Some are influenced by each other, some are more avant-garde and kind of just seemingly come out of nowhere. Okay, so make sure you're on slide one and you're taking notes on Cubism. So Cubism was actually founded by two different artists. The first you've, I'm sure, heard of, Pablo Picasso, and the second is the not so famous but just as important Georges Braque. And so Cubism was the first artistic modern movement that rivaled Impressionism in terms of its global reach and influence. And like Impressionism, it also had international significance. So the Cubists get their name from the same art critic who named the Fauves. So this art critic was looking at the work of Georges Braque, and he referred to it as bizarre little cubes. And so basically, like the Fauves, this art movement gets its name based on what people see on the surface. And so Cubism is considered to be the most original invention of 20th century art. And what Cubism is going to do that's so different is they're going to abandon the use of a single viewpoint, meaning that when you're looking at an artwork, as someone in the audience viewing the artwork, there's basically one perspective, one view you're looking for. When you're looking through Cubism, you can almost see where there's different views happening at the same time. And I hope I can make that clear with this lecture. So the Cubists are going to abandon that view, single viewpoint, and instead they're going to use geometric shapes and forms, interlocking planes, and later collage in order to create this varied viewpoint. And we'll talk about the modern significance of that towards the end of the segment on Cubism. So go ahead and move to slide two, which is the roots of Cubism. Like the Fauves, the Cubists also looked at Cézanne. But for Cézanne, in terms of what was so interesting about Cézanne, was the way that he broke down shapes and forms. So what you're looking at on this slide, as you guys take notes, is a view of Mount Saint-Victoire by Cézanne. You looked at that in the post-impressionist module. And if you look at the forms, they're broken. Not all the lines connect, not all the shapes are complete. And this is something that we can refer to as like a breakdown of form. So the Cubists are also going to break down objects, but to an even greater degree than Cézanne did. And so the Cubists are going to follow Cézanne in terms of breaking down shape and form, but where they deter from Cézanne is they don't really have an interest in using color in an expressive way. When we start to look at more Cubist artwork, you guys will find that the colors, until we get into like later phases of Cubism that we don't study, are typically pretty like neutral and muted, and that's because when the color is downplayed, it forces the viewer to pay more attention to the forms. And we'll see that in action in a second. And so development of Cubism is often compared with powerful artistic phenomenon such as the Renaissance. Like when we talk about moments in art history that matter, that nothing will ever be the same following those moments, you know, you can punctuate that timeline with Contrapposto and Doryphorus, the canon of Polykleitos. You can move forward to Giotto, the father of Western painting, who introduces naturalism back into art. And then you can talk about the Renaissance, where intellect and knowledge and all these technical innovations make art different than it's ever been before. Cubism also has that reputation. So people want to see a rebirth in painting. Keep in mind, we're in the modern era. The world is changing. Time is centralized. You can ride on a train. There's inventions. Albert Einstein discovers things. Psychology becomes a field. So my point of rambling on all these innovations is that the world's a different place. And the way people see the world changes the way they see themselves. And the art is going to reflect that. Art becomes endowed with the power to attempt to redefine the relationship between what we see in the world and what that means. And the Cubists definitely take advantage of that capability that's possible within art. The inventors of Cubism, Braque and Picasso, are so intertwined during the early years of Cubism when they're making all these innovations that it's kind of hard to tell their artwork apart. But thank goodness in the 250, the artworks you guys have to look at should help you make that distinction. Okay, go ahead and move to slide 3, and we're going to start focusing on Picasso. So you don't have anything to do on this slide, but I just wanted to give you guys a moment to look. So before we get into Picasso's artwork, keep in mind that Picasso was an artistic prodigy at a very young age. He was copying works of Renaissance masters. He had an incredible gift for painting and drawing. And so he starts to look at other things that he can pull into artwork. You know, back to the phrase I say a lot in these lectures, the world is changing. So the way we see the world is also changing, and artists are struggling to represent that. So we've talked about quite a few artists that are looking for outside influences. We know that in your last lecture with Matisse and the Fauves, he escapes the chaos and the pressure of Paris by going to Morocco and moving into the countryside. We know about Gauguin, who went to Tahiti to also escape those pressures. And artists like Picasso also looked for other influences. And two of those influences include Iberian sculpture, which you can see on the left. And the Iberians lived in the Iberian Peninsula area of Europe, and they existed before the Romans. So it's an ancient culture. So Picasso saw some of that sculpture, and in a moment, we're going to take a look at how it influences artwork. And then on the right side, we have African masks. So remember, Europe is colonizing the world at this time, and objects are coming back into Europe that the world has never seen before. And so prior to the invention of Cubism, there's a very famous art show in Paris that you can read about. It's called the Trocadero Show. And it was basically an art show that displayed objects from the colonized world. So there was objects from Africa. And the masks you're looking at now are actually objects that were displayed in the Trocadero Show that Picasso went to go visit. And he was very influenced by what he saw in that show. So by 1906, I think as early as 1906, Picasso's searching for new ways to depict form. Remember, he's a talented art prodigy. He is a skilled artist, and he's just looking for something new. And so looking at this sculpture, and also looking back at the paintings of Cézanne, give him kind of a wider exposure and a new way to represent the world and the paintings that he creates. And so a product of that curiosity is the painting that you're going to see on slide 4 called Demoiselles d'Avignon. Now, the title of this painting is kind of like, if you know, you know type situation. So it translates to the young women of Avignon. And so if you were from France, you would know exactly like what that's referring to. And so Avignon is a street that's essentially like a red light district. So that's where there's going to be brothels and prostitutes. I mean, anything happening on that street is associated with those types of professions and those types of establishments. So if you were French, you would see this title and you would know exactly what you're looking at. You're looking at 5 prostitutes in a painting. Now, just to take a look at how this is different, just to kind of get an entry point as you guys take notes, what we're looking at, it's almost like we're stepping into the brothel and these 5 women are looking back at us. We're going to take a closer look in a second of how that Iberian sculpture and how the African masks actually make a kind of a play and really change the way we look at these figures. But before we do that, let's just kind of go back to the basics and look at the formal elements. I told you guys that with Cubism, color is mostly minimized in order to give you an opportunity to really pay attention to the shapes, the forms, and how those things interact together. So if you notice with these colors, we have some kind of rusty orange, but not really a bright orange. I mean, not like a Matisse goldfish orange. Like a rust tone on the left, which kind of transition into these like pink peachy tones. We have gray. We have a slightly muted blue. And that's kind of the extent of this color palette. There's like a couple like moments of green in the right corner on the face of the woman in that right corner. Yeah, and I think that kind of covers what we see in terms of colors. In terms of how you describe how this looks, we see a lot of fractured shapes. We see figures that are slightly abstracted. We see a space that is hard to define exactly, like what we're looking at. Like, is there furniture? Are we outside? Are we inside? Are they coming out to greet us? Are we coming in to greet them? It's very ambiguous because that kind of information isn't necessarily given to us in this image. So before we proceed further about what we're looking at, let's take a look at slide 5. And I have kind of a drag and drop moment for you. So there's two images of what we saw in previous slides of these outside influences from Picasso. So what I want you to do is take the two images and drag them to the side that they belong. And so what I mean by that is on the left side of the image, the three women to the left standing have kind of a connection to either the sculpture, which is outlined in blue, or the mask that's outlined in yellow. So drag the corresponding influence to the left, and to the right, drag the object that you think corresponds to the way the two women figures look on the right. And on the right, I'm referring to the woman in the crouching position and the woman in the right corner, kind of near that blue color. So sorry, this is kind of confusing, but I'll give you a few seconds. On the left side, you should drag the piece of art that influenced the figures on the left. And on the right side, you should drag the artwork that influences the figures on the right. So I'll give you a few seconds to do that. Kind of look at the way the faces look. The shape, the style, the shapes of the eyes, the way the noses look. That's one option you can consider. Another thing you can consider is maybe the colors. I think the use of color on the demoiselles of Avignon also kind of give that influence. And so take a couple more seconds and make your final choice, and then I'll reveal the answers right away. Okay, so what you should have on the left side is the Iberian sculpture to the left of the painting, and then you should drag the African mask that's outlined in yellow to the right side of the painting. So in terms of influences, Picasso kind of selected which women receive which influence in terms of how these figures look in the painting. The figures on the left most emulate the Iberian sculpture. Now, looking at the Iberian sculpture, you can kind of see that the face is not symmetrical. The eye on the left, that as we face the figure, is much larger than the eye on the right. The chin kind of comes out to the right side. Not quite a point, but we don't see symmetry in the face. And you can definitely see those qualities in the three women on the left. They don't have symmetry. The nose kind of drags out a little bit to one direction. The eyes are that very, like, abstracted almond shape. Now, the figures on the right, the standing woman and also the crouching woman, they resemble the African masks that Picasso saw in the Trocadero show. They have very abstracted features. The woman who's standing, her nose is like a slope. Her face is gray. We have that dual tonality we see in the mask that Picasso would have seen at the Trocadero show. We have a very defined, continuous brow. On the figure on the bottom that's crouching, that one has definitely the most obvious connections to an African mask. We have that orange color. We have a face that definitely lacks symmetry, and it's very easy to see the type of geometrical forms that comprise the face. It's almost easier to talk about that masked figure in terms of shapes than it is to talk about it in terms of human anatomical features. Okay, you can go ahead and advance to slide 6. So in slide 6, we're revisiting the subject of this. So far what we know is we know how this looks. We know it's cubist. We know that Picasso was very influenced by primitive influences, including Iberian sculpture and African masks that he would have viewed in the Trocadero show in Paris. But the subject matter is not new. The subject matter of the prostitute, really, in terms of fine art, originates with Manet. Manet's Olympia, 1863. What made this so shocking is Manet was one of the first artists to communicate the modern experience. The world has changed, and the type of people living in this urban, populated world changes along with it. And so remember, Manet is intended to, he's showing a prostitute in Olympia. She's looking out at the audience, directly engaging the male gaze. Typically, reclining female nudes are like shy or look away, are more objectified. She is more confrontational and direct in this image. And we also have those characteristics as well from the Demoiselles of Avignon, where whoever is entering into the pictorial space of this is being confronted by the directness of their gaze. Let's move on to slide 7, where we're going to take a look at how the shapes and the forms really contribute to this varied viewpoint in comparison to these single vantage points that we've seen so far in art. So as you're taking notes on this, I did include some annotations to draw your attention to the right areas of the painting. So the first thing I want to call attention to is the yellow lines. And I use these lines to annotate some interesting areas of the forms that are hard to distinguish and make meaning of. So why don't you go ahead and take a look at the yellow lines I have on the left side of the painting near the female figure that's inspired by an Iberian sculpture. So in terms of form, the forms are incomplete. The shapes don't finish. Some of them have endings, like you can kind of see like a line that stops and another line that starts. And some seem to kind of be like they're layered on other shapes, or they're translucent, or they're blending into something else. So on the left side, it's kind of uncertain whether we're looking at like a door or some kind of curtain. We can see that woman on the left has her arm raised up like she's either resting her hand on something or she's pushing something away. That part's very unclear. So with that yellow line at the top left, you can kind of see a layer of something. And it's hard to distinguish what that layer is. If you move down closer to the foreground, the second yellow line on the left side, I wanted to call your attention to that because that's a great example of an area where the forms and the shapes are hard to distinguish. So if you look at whether this is a curtain or a door frame, whatever this is intended to be, those forms seem to fuse along with her right leg, or at least where we expect her right leg to be logically. So it's hard to determine what we're looking at because we're not sure if we're looking at an object or part of her body. That line is really hard to decipher. And the color also makes it challenging because the color doesn't help us understand the shapes and the forms. Now let's take a look at the yellow lines that are on the right. And so this is also interesting because we have one of the women who are inspired by the African masks coming maybe forward or backward. There's not enough information to really make that decision. And so what we see here is the woman has her arms maybe behind a curtain. And so those two yellow lines are kind of designating those areas. Now, it's hard to understand if we're looking at a curtain or some type of drapery, because although there's lines that could suggest form, the shapes aren't solid. The shapes don't have clarity. And so you really aren't sure what it is that you're looking at because it's not logical. Another thing I want to call your attention to is the woman who is crouching in the orange African mask. I put an orange arrow next to her. So in terms of the shapes and form, when it comes to her face, we have a variety of shapes. Yes, it's more geometric in nature versus natural, but we can see eyes and probably a nose and where her chin's supposed to be. With the body, we really don't have very much detail. She's in a crouched position, but it's difficult to tell whether we're looking at her back. Maybe we're looking at the front. There's not enough information, or the way that the forms overlap make that challenging to make a decision. The last thing I want to take a look at and have you guys take notes on is also the little kind of fruit bowl or the fruit arrangement we have in the foreground of the painting. I've called attention to that with the pink arrow. And so when we're looking at this, we're assuming that the fruit is sitting on some kind of table. So we have what looks like grapes, maybe a slice of watermelon, And are they on top of some kind of like tablecloth or napkin? How are they able to rest upon this very flattened shape? It kind of defies logic, and it really forces us to view the painting in a way where that's not really what's important and what Picasso really wants us to focus on. So overall, taking a look at this, we've talked a lot about single viewpoint, and you're probably thinking, well, I'm looking at this on my own. That's a single view. Think of viewpoints as in, if you had to like move around in this painting, say you were life-size with this painting and you could walk into this space. Well, maybe you'd walk in towards the center, but that's challenging too. You have the table and the fruit in your way, and then you're confronted by the figure in the center with her arms open. If you want to move to the right, it's almost as if the crouching figure is at like a different angle, and your entry point would be across the front right corner of the painting. Say you wanted to move from the left side, move into the artwork. We have three figures that are standing that are all facing different angles. So it's really hard to tell where the focal point of this is. It's really hard to determine how one would logically move through this space. It just doesn't make sense. And I think overall with cubism, that what the point Picasso is trying to make with a painting like this is that you can't understand the world and you can't understand life's experiences. And so he's trying to create a visual means that really takes into account the complexities and the challenges of modern life. Now let's move on to slide 8 to take a look at another cubist painting, this one by George Brock. So George Brock has a painting that we're looking at, and it's called The Portuguese. So you should be on slide 8, and I made a little table for you guys to look and make some notes. So I'll kind of guide you through this. Take your time. There's no rush. The more you look, the more you'll understand. So first thing I want you to do, next to the space where it says first impression, kind of take general inventory into the picture. What do you see? Maybe you can describe the color. Maybe you see an object. Maybe you see something that looks familiar. Maybe you can talk about the line. Consider how you could describe the shapes. Once again, going back to color, how could you describe these colors? You've seen other art movements that have used colors in very different way. Think back to Matisse's The Goldfish. That was described as vibrant, complementary colors, bright orange, subtle pinks. None of those words connect to this image. So what words could you use instead? Now in the second space, we have letters, numbers, and words. So what I'd like you guys to try to do is see if you can make any meaning from the letters or words that we see here. There's some letters in the top right corner of the painting. There's some kind of scattered, there's letters I see, and then I question myself, am I looking at a letter? And there's also some letters at the top left of the painting. The next thing I'd like you guys to record is figures. Do you see any people? Do you see any animals? Do you see anything that you can make any sense of? The next thing I'd like you to record are objects. Are there any objects that you can see in this painting? Okay, and with that last notation, go ahead and move to slide 9. So I'd like you guys to take notes on slide 9 about The Portuguese. So a little bit about The Portuguese. This was painted by, obviously, George Brock. We've mentioned that before. But he was in a bar or a cafe, and he met a Portuguese man one day who was a musician. And that experience compelled him to later on create a painting around that particular person. So sometimes knowing a little bit about the actual subject of the painting via the title can be also like quite helpful. So in The Portuguese, with cubism, let's give you guys a few more details about cubism. Cubism as I referred to a little bit with Demoiselles, is very much marked by its historical context, particularly revolutions in science and technology. So, for example, during this time, the X-ray is invented. Einstein and Freud reveal things to the world that people couldn't even comprehend. And not to go into any of their theories, Freud's theories are no longer considered to be like scientifically valid, but they did set the foundation for psychology. But basically what these things point to is that there's truth and there's knowledge about the world that exists beyond the surface of what we could see. So prior to the modern era, if something's true, you can see it. But now people are learning about science and people are learning about relativity and people are hearing about psychology. And so it makes them question what they see in the world. So looking at the Portuguese, it's very abstract at first glance, but actually Cubists were really focused on creating things in a natural manner. I know that sounds crazy, but stick with me. They wanted to portray things in the way that we truly experience the world. So Picasso and Braque were a lot like scientists in a way. And what I mean by that is they really took the time to understand the world and they really took the time to analyze the subjects of their paintings and their sculptures. So what an artist like Braque can show us is how an object could look if it's moving through space and time. It's almost like creating a fourth dimension in the pictorial surface where, yes, we're looking at the Portuguese, but we're looking at several different sides of the Portuguese and the objects around the Portuguese at the same time. And so this idea of showing things as they exist and also including movement is really important to the new modern era of speed and technology. I mean, that's just something that's very 20th century. So why don't we go ahead and move to slide 10? This is going to be really hard to show over the slide, but I'm going to try to point some things out to you. So let's reference that idea I told you guys as you look about showing the same object with multiple views at the same time. So basically what he's done here is he's broken up the human figure and he's replicated it in certain parts of the painting. So what I circled in yellow is the profile of the man. And the best way to see the profile is if you look for that strong diagonal that separates like kind of like a dark plane and a lighter plane, and you can see the profile of the nose. Once you see the profile of the nose, I see like a closed eyelid. I don't know if what's beneath the profile of his nose is his chin. Maybe it's a mustache. Maybe it's part of his mouth. That's kind of indistinguishable. Another thing you can take a look at is what I've annotated with the pink arrow. So in the pink arrow, what I kind of see is another kind of fragmentation of a man's face. I see what I think is a man looking down, like as if he's laying down, kind of in a profile view. Maybe that area that I thought was a chin or a mustache is kind of turned upside down, but I see another face. Another thing I see with the blue arrow is maybe a portion of someone's face. So what we're looking at here, it's very hard to distinguish. It's very hard to make sense of it. But what Braque is trying to do is he's trying to create a new view of how we experience the world. The earth tones in this painting, we talked about color before with the Cubist, are essentially something that is supposed to help kind of like your search as you kind of look through this image. The colors are essential. They're minimalized because it helps you focus on the form. And so when you walk away from a Cubist painting, the goal isn't to have you understand every element of it to a scientific degree. The goal is to have a new understanding of the way that you experience the world. All right, the next movement we're going to take a look at is early abstraction. Early abstraction is referring to artists who are going to begin to abstract in their artwork. Not completely, but this is kind of like the beginnings of it. So if you go to slide 11, let me make sure that I'm still following this progression. You're going to be taking notes on Improvisation 28, second version by Kandinsky. So first, let's talk about the title. This title will also give us some meaning. Improvisation is actually a musical reference. And so in this painting, we have a reference to sound, which is quite unusual. Typically in paintings, we have names that relate to like a person, historical event, something allegorical, a battle, a place, you know, something more physical. But what he's doing here is something different. He's composing with form and shape. The way a musician would compose with notes and harmonies and music, he's composing with visual elements. And so what Kandinsky is trying to do is he's associating painting with music. And like music, painting can mean things. Painting can take us to places without representing anything concrete. And let me unpack that idea a little bit. So when you listen to music, you don't see anything. There's nothing you can touch. There's nothing concrete. There's no fixed references. Music takes you where you want to go, what connects with you and your memories and your emotions. And when you hear a note, it might have one specific response for you, but for someone else, it might take them somewhere different. So Kandinsky's really capitalizing on that idea where music can really help you understand, help you experience something. And he's trying to evoke those same qualities with something physical. Now, go ahead and move to the next slide. And so as we look at this next slide, I'm going to play some music in the background, and it might be a little annoying, but I'll explain why in a moment. I get to a good part. All right, so here we go. So this is a painting that makes you see and listen. And so right now we're listening to Schoenberg playing in the background. And I want this to purposely be chaotic and annoying, so just bear with me for a second. So what was so interesting about Schoenberg was he was a turn-of-the-century composer. And what he tried to do as a musician was create new harmonies and melodies for the turn of the century. So like artists who were trying to create a new visual means to represent the new modern world, there are musicians who are doing these same things. And so Schoenberg is known for atonal music, which means it lacks harmony, lacks melody, and has no like unifying center. And so Kandinsky was really inspired by this kind of chaotic type music. So I'm going to let you listen to it for a little while, then I'll come back to this. Okay, I'm going to pause that because I know it's kind of hard to listen to both at the same time. But what I wanted you to experience is that atonal music, lacking harmony, lack of melody. With Schoenberg, that doesn't make the music not sound beautiful or something that an audience can appreciate. It creates a different type of atmosphere. The atmosphere is chaotic and disjointed. And as I talked and played the music, I wanted to do that because I wanted you guys to feel chaotic and confused, because that's definitely something that artists were trying to convey in their artwork. Schoenberg with his music and Kandinsky with trying to make you feel like the music when you look at his painting. So when you're looking at Kandinsky's painting, what you should notice is brilliant color. You should notice kind of like this hazy atmosphere. I think one of the best places to see that is if you take a look at kind of like the top third of the painting in the center. There's kind of like a round object, but it's like a curvy, squiggly line with like an orange dot in the center. The color that fills that particular form is just kind of hazy, not quite blended, not completely disjointed. Some of the colors really fuse together in this hazy atmospheric way. Now take a look at the black diagonals, which we have these like lines all over the painting. In some areas, it kind of almost look like sheet music a little bit, where you have like, if you guys know music, I can't think of the word right now, so I apologize. But like the musical bar, is that what it's called? Where you kind of put the notes into the sheet music. So those successive lines on the right side of the painting also have those particular qualities. And so Kandinsky, like the music he's so inspired by, also communicates this kind of chaos. And for Kandinsky, the modern world was full of chaos and also political chaos as well. Kandinsky is Russian, and at this time in Russia, there is an incredible amount of political chaos. We're about to enter the world wars, and so from what you guys know about history, we know that Europe experienced a lot of chaos at that time. Now, this is early abstraction, so we don't recognize everything in this painting. There are some elements we can recognize, and that's really intentional. Because from Kandinsky's point of view, his belief is that if things are too clear in a painting while you're viewing it, your logical mind is going to take over. And the reason that your logical mind taking over would be a problem for Kandinsky is because he wants you to respond with your emotion. He wants you to respond with whatever feeling you have about the colors and the forms. So go ahead right now and move to slide 13. And I'm going to point out some of those recognizable images that we can see. Now, at first glance, you're probably like, I don't know what I'm looking at all. But in fact, once I point your direction to a couple of these things, it's going to make a lot of sense. It's really interesting. And the cool thing about Kandinsky that you're just not going to understand how interesting this is in AP art history, but he kind of has a visual language. Like if you look at a lot of Kandinsky's artwork, he reuses some of the symbols and motifs, and there's kind of like a language to his artwork. Like there's certain elements that he always has in his painting, and I'll explain those once I point those out. So Kandinsky was influenced by biblical imagery. He was tremendously modern, but he still represents elements from Christian stories. And so one of those elements is, if you look where the yellow arrow is, most art historians think that that building that's on top of a hill, and once I say it's a building on a hill, hopefully you're kind of like, oh, okay, I see that too. Many believe that that's a church. And so we have a church on a hill. The next thing I want you to take a look at that also ties to Christian imagery is the blue arrow on the bottom left corner. Many art historians describe that as a wave. And so water and a wave, the way that would come together is the Old Testament of the Christian Bible, the story of Noah's Ark, where God sends down an incredible flood to basically cleanse the world and start anew. And so this is almost like a battlefield apocalypse type scene where moments of sins are washed away. All of the sins that the world has created have a chance to be cleansed from the earth. And that wave and that reference to Noah's Ark definitely can help keep that meaning. Now, back to this idea of like a battle, an apocalypse. The atmosphere seems very like smoky. So kind of like those hazy parts of the painting can kind of create the impression that there's some action, there's some battle going on. If you take a look at the pink arrow on the top left, that's probably someone riding on a horse. And so the way you can make meaning of that is if you look at kind of like the rounded red dot, that could be a head. And the person's body is wearing like white with like kind of like a splash of purple. And it's seated upon like an orange figure that kind of goes horizontal. I know these are kind of funny to describe. Hopefully, if you're looking at the arrow, you should see that. That could be someone riding a horse. Now, another reference to horse is with the yellow arrow. Now, this one you'll find interesting. So I put the arrow in the most obvious space, but kind of like those half circle rounded shapes. The one my arrow is directed towards kind of looks like a centipede because it has kind of like these thin eyelash looking gestures. And what many art historians believe is that that is intended to be like the back of the horse's like neck. So like if you look at a horse, like where the horse's mane would be, kind of that rounded area of the horse's head. And so you can see a variety of those rounded shapes. So that would be kind of like a variety of horses in this one area. And then the last area I want to point your attention to is near the green arrow, where it kind of looks like either two or one person in profile, maybe with their eye closed. So if you look at the green arrow, it's pointed directly to what I think looks maybe like a nose or a mouth. And underneath that shape is a closed eye. And so maybe that's a reference to death or somebody dying. And so what Kandinsky is really exploring here is washing away the world through battle, through a war. And from that, the world's sins can be washed away, kind of like that Noah's Ark reference. And then the world can move forward. In some modern art movements, and there's one modern art movement we're not going to study, because not in the 250, it's referred to as futurism. Artists at this time actually welcomed war and battle and chaos. They felt like the world needed to purge itself of everything bad and have some kind of new start. And so, remember, this is before the world wars, and so people don't really understand how much catastrophe can happen. But at this point, artists are very confident that sometimes purging the world of its sins is what it's going to take to move forward. And artists like Kandinsky saw themselves as someone who could play a new role in civilization, someone who could speak messages and really represent what the world should be. And so overall, your takeaway from this painting should be that we're looking at color in a brand new radical way. There's rhythm with the color in line that corresponds to music. The title corresponds to music. The experience corresponds to music. And then we have some familiar elements that kind of help us make meaning. All right, you can advance to Expressionism. We're going to look at two artworks in Expressionism. Slide 14. Now, this is usually an artwork every year that people really enjoy and find to be really memorable. So just kind of give it a chance. It's a little jarring to look at first. Okay, so what we're looking at is something that is definitely indicative of psychological drama. So we're looking at Self-Portrait as a Soldier. On the left, we see in the foreground the figure of focus, Kirchner, who is a German expressionist and who is painting himself. So he's painted himself standing in a soldier's uniform. He's in his studio, and we can see that because on the left behind him, we kind of see what looks like a painting. We have a nude model directly behind him. And then behind the nude model, it looks like maybe there's like another canvas or something that he's painting on. So as he's standing in his studio, he has an amputated bloody arm, the nude model behind him, and the significance of the amputated hand should make you wonder, okay, if he has an amputated hand, how can he paint? In reality, Kirchner did not lose his hand when he fought in World War I. This is more of like a symbolic loss of the hand, and we'll get more into that a little bit later. But the contrast between the artist's clothing and the studio space definitely lets us read this as a complicated coming-of-age portrait. Kirchner is redefining his understanding of himself and really giving us an ominous, harrowing understanding of who he is as an artist. Okay, you can advance to slide 15, and we're going to take a look at the art movement that he helped found. So Kirchner was involved in an artistic group. Now, the group name isn't like the artistic style or movement. It's basically like an artistic association. So he founded the German Expressionist group. And if you speak German, I apologize for my awful pronunciation, but it was Die Brücke. And that translates to the bridge. So just like we talked about Kandinsky, like having this desire to move society forward in a new way, the German Expressionists also saw that, which that's where the bridge metaphor comes from. So the bridge was supposed to be a metaphor for connecting to the barbarism of the past and moving forward with modernity and the future. So it was really art that was connected to looking at the past and the future as once at the same time. So it's not like leaving the past behind. It's, you know, keeping those strong ties, but moving forward into the future. The image you're looking at is a woodblock print of the German expressionist De Brueghe group's manifesto. And on this woodblock print, he widely disseminated this. And let me read some of the text in my English version, obviously, that's represented here. So a portion of this reads, "We call all young people together as young people who carry the future in us. We want to wrest freedom from our actions and our lives from the older, comfortably established forces." So De Brueghe artists were definitely set about creating an entirely new way of being an artist and using art to help society move into the future. Okay, go ahead and move to slide 16. We have another artist who is looking at primitive influences. And so, like Matisse and the Fauves, like Pablo Picasso and Cubism, we also have Kirchner looking at his own primitive influences. And so in terms of his primitive influences, remember that primitive art is art and ritual objects from ancient cultures or non-Western societies. So it has a connection to like time and then also place in the world. But typically when you talk about primitive art, we're talking about art from Africa or Central Asia. And sometimes we can even be talking about folk art. So, you know, primitive art, hopefully it's kind of having meaning for you at this point. But the best way to think about this interest that modern artists have in primitive art is that they view it as being more authentic, honest, and direct compared to what's happening in modern Europe. These artists also felt that it was more natural. So the interest in primitive art, like folk art, which you can see in the top image and kind of the floral image on the bottom right, is that it's kind of like going back to your roots and looking at the past. And that definitely connects to that tenet of the De Brueghe Manifesto, where it's like looking at the past and moving to the future. So Germany remained a major colonial power in Africa through the First World War. So a German artist like Kirchner would see things like African masks. That undeniable primitive aesthetic, despite the fact that Kirchner is a modern artist, he definitely has like a primitive sensibility, has a strong impact on Kirchner and his expressionist art. So in terms of how does this influence? Well, if you look at the folk art, remember the top image and the image on the bottom right, we have kind of like an outline, a lot of natural forms, no chiaroscuro, basically like an application of paint that is colorful and also lacks naturalism. And in terms of the African mask, this interest in really stylizing objects and deviating from what's natural. Okay, you can go ahead and move to slide 17. Slide 17, you're not taking notes, you're just looking. So how do all these things come together? If you're taking a look at these two images, what I want you to see from these images are two views of Kirchner. The image on the left is an image of Kirchner before World War I, and the image of Kirchner on the right was painted after World War I. Kirchner was an artist before he went to war. World War I was fought by everybody, whether you're an artist, whether you were an author. It was something that everybody who were at those coming of age years experienced at Europe at this time. And so what you should see in his artwork is, yes, we see that primitive folk art color. We see like the bright colors and we don't see like the modeling and the shading. But what we see that's very different on the image in the right is we definitely see kind of a more ominous image of Kirchner. Kirchner on the left is holding a paintbrush. His face, although it does have kind of like that simple abstracted quality, doesn't have the same like kind of ominous hollow look that we see in the figure on the right. So the suggestion here is that the war changed Kirchner. That's kind of the takeaway you should be looking at from this image. During the war, Kirchner suffered from alcoholism and drug abuse, and there was a time when his hands and his feet were partially paralyzed. So his fears about the war were essentially like self-fulfilling. Kirchner did recover from his alcoholist drug abuse and also from his hand and feet paralysis. And following the war, when he created art, his subject matter definitely becomes a lot more disillusioned, a lot more depressing. But his work does become internationally exhibited, and he receives a lot of acclaim during the interwar period. And so that refers to like the period of time between World War I and World War II. And so your takeaway from this image, before we get to the next German expressionist artwork, is that the experience of war had a psychological impact on Kirchner. It changed his view of himself. It made him feel as if maybe he couldn't follow his calling as an artist. And, you know, it's kind of easy to make these assumptions about expressionist paintings because you can really understand the emotional and the psychological element of this. We've seen paintings of artists. You guys saw Dürer's self-portrait. You saw Rembrandt's self-portrait with Saskia, where the artist is really elevating his status and making a statement about his technical abilities and intellect. Here you have a different kind of statement. You have a statement from an artist who's damaged, who's suffering, and trying to understand his new place in the world after he's been a soldier. All right, you can go ahead and advance to slide number 18, where we're going to look at Katie Kollwitz's memorial sheet of Karl Liebknecht. So on this slide, you're going to be taking notes. You're looking at a woodblock print, and she is a female artist, so that's also important. So a little bit about Kollwitz. Prior to World War I, Germans were excited to fight in the Great War. There was a great sense of like national pride, and many Germans actually championed the prospect of going to war and being a powerful nation. So before World War I, that was Kollwitz's perspective. Following the war, her son died in World War I, as many families lost their sons, and she actually became a pacifist and became someone who in her art was very aggressively opposed to war. So in terms of this art, in the political turmoil after the First World War, a lot of artists turned to prints instead of paintings. And remember, the benefit of prints is you can produce multiple copies of the same image, and it's a really good way to spread a political idea because you can disseminate the information to the masses. So Katie Kollwitz is German, and she almost exclusively works in the medium of prints, and she becomes very famous for her woodblock prints, and they become something that celebrate the plight of the working class and really give a voice to people who are marginalized in society. So she rarely depicted real people, so that makes this particular print unusual, and she always used her talents in support to give a voice to the causes that she believed in. So in this work, it was created in 1920 in response to the assassination of communist leader Karl Liebknecht during an uprising in 1919. This work is really unique among her other prints, which we'll take a look at in upcoming slides, because although it memorializes Karl Liebknecht, but it does so without advocating what he stands for. So typically when we see a political leader who's killed or assassinated, there's something in the artwork that speaks to their cause, what they believe in, what they stand for. But that's not the kind of focus that she's created in this image. So a little bit more about politics at this time. So from the end of the First World War in 1918 to the founding of the Weimar Republic, Germany went through a period of social and political upheaval. During this time, Germany was led by a coalition of left-wing forces that had Marxist, communist sympathies, the largest of which was the Social Democratic Party of Germany, or the SPD. Other more radical groups were trying to control Germany at this time, including the newly founded German Communist Party. So we have a socialist group and a communist group who want to eliminate capitalism, and they want to establish some kind of communal control over the means of production in Germany. But while socialists believed the best way to achieve that goal was to work step by step within the capitalist structure, the communists wanted a complete and immediate social revolution that would take away all government power and put power back into the hands of the workers. So you can think of it like socialists at this time wanted to gradually change the capitalist system, and the communists wanted to stop everything and put the power in the hands of the people. So in this spirit, the Communist Party of Germany staged an uprising. So military units come in, they suppress the uprising, and they capture two of the Communist Party leaders, which is connected to this image. They capture Rosa Luxemburg and the man who this image memorializes, Karl Liebknecht. Liebknecht and Luxemburg were murdered while they were in custody, and their deaths really struck a chord across the left-wing landscape, and they kind of become like martyrs or like patron saints for the communist cause. Kollwitz was not a communist, and she even acknowledged that the communist and the socialist parties could have had better leaders. So she's not necessarily creating this image to like elevate his status or show her support for Karl Liebknecht and his party. But she did hear Liebknecht speak, and she admired his charisma and his sincerity and his passion. So when his family asked her to create an artwork to memorialize him, she immediately agreed. Okay, you can go ahead and move to the next slide. Sorry, I gotta look at my notes. You should be on slide 18. So what we're looking at is something we can make a connection to with an artwork you should definitely know. If you don't know this artwork, this is a big one on the left. So you're looking at a lamentation. So let me make this connection in a second. So the memorial sheet of Karl Liebknecht in the style of a lamentation, that's kind of her idea when she created this. And a lamentation is a traditional motif in Christian art where there's a depiction of Christ who has already died, his body's taken off the cross, and his mother and his followers surround him and mourn him. And so what you see on the left with Giotto's lamentation is you see the body of Christ, as I mentioned, surrounded by his followers. Everybody's in a different state of expressing their grief and their emotion, and he's laying in the arms of his mother. And so in Kollwitz's version, where she makes the memorial sheet of Karl Liebknecht, she's casting Liebknecht kind of in that role of Christ. She's not likening him to Christ. She's taking familiar iconography in order to really cast an emphasis on basically the followers, the group of people. She's trying to show how his death impacted the masses. And that's what's really clear with this image. So the iconography of a lamentation would have easily been recognizable by the masses, who are the artist's intended audience. Okay, you can go ahead and go to the next slide, which is slide 18. So Kollwitz's memorial for Karl Liebknecht focuses not on the man himself. The true focus is actually on the workers who had put their faith in him. The focus on those broadly affected, rather than people in the spotlight, are something that we definitely see in a lot of Kollwitz's artwork. And some of her most famous artworks always show the people who are like not always represented, people who are truly affected. So when she creates artwork, and much of her artwork is in connection or response to World War I and World War II, she doesn't depict war in the sense of soldiers fighting or battles being won. What she does depict is who is really affected by war. She depicts the women and the children who are left behind and starving. So the images I have for you on slide 18, we have the memorial sheet for Karl Liebknecht on the top left. I outlined it in yellow just to kind of contrast it with everything you see here. But if you look at the top right image, you can see just these horribly just agonized faces of children, of women, people with their eyes covered, these very like hollow eyes. The figure in the top right image, she looks very skeletal. Like her face looks like the skull. I mean, if this makes you think of The Scream, that's appropriate. It's a generic figure who definitely ties into images of death. The figures on the bottom, on the left, we have figures holding each other, grasping each other. And on the right, I know it's kind of small, but I hope you can see it. We have a group of grieving women, and then we have a small child in front of the grieving woman in the center. So what's really significant about Kollwitz's artwork is that she doesn't put the focus on the war, on Karl Liebknecht. She puts the focus on who's truly impacted by some of the horrible atrocities that happen in our world. Now, let's take a closer look at the composition. You can go ahead and move to slide 19. So the composition is essentially divided into three horizontal sections. And I try to annotate those with brackets so that you guys could get a much closer look. So what I like you guys to do is take notes on what we see in the top of the composition, the middle, and the bottom. So those three horizontal sections are basically just some details I want to make sure you guys are taking a look at. So the top section is densely packed with figures. Make sure you have that in your notes. The faces are well modeled. They have interesting depth, but the space is very compressed. Like, you just feel like it's a very packed image. Like, you could not fit another person into that space. Those figures are so tightly packed. I think the impression that that gives is that there's multitudes of people coming to pay their respects. So many people are coming to pay their respects that it's hard to fit more people into this scene. And she shows this scene without compromising the individuality of the subjects. So what I mean by that is, in that top register, although she has a group of people, they're all individualized. Their facial features are different. Some have facial hair, some look young, some look old. So she's really trying to show that there is a great multitude of people coming to pay their respects. And most importantly, because remember, the focus is on the crowd, she's trying to really call attention to these people who have been traumatized or affected by the assassination of their leader. So the middle compositional area contains fewer details. And so these fewer details that we see in the middle also help facilitate the emphasis happening at the top. So because the middle contains less details, you look longer in the top area. You look for more detail. You know that's more important. So the middle strata draws attention to the specific action of the bending mourner. And then the bending mourner puts his hand on Liebknecht's chest. And so that motion, or it's not really a motion, that gesture connects the middle strata to the bottommost level of the composition. And in the bottom area of the composition, we have the martyred revolutionary. There's no action. There's no motion. I feel like if you didn't know the subject of this before you took a close look, you might not immediately recognize that all these figures are here mourning somebody. Because we know that the more important part of the scene are those who are affected by his death. So just kind of taking an overall look at this, women and children are a central concern of Kollwitz's work, as you saw in the slide image before. And this makes her a very unique voice in a creative environment dominated by young men. Kollwitz was recognized in her time as, you know, an artist accepted to the Prussian Academy of Art. And she also includes women and children in this image as well. Okay, you can go ahead and move to our last slide on Kollwitz. This should be slide 20. So slide 20, we can't talk about Kollwitz without talking about her technique, woodblock print. And so woodblock print is a technique where a design is carved into a slab of wood. You can see that on the right. Obviously, the slide on the right is a modern image. The person carving has blue nail polish and it's a colored image. But I liked this image because you can see the tools. You can see the technique, which we're going to talk about in a second. So you carve into a slab of wood, you cover that with ink, and then you use that kind of like a stamp on paper. So the ink coats the original surface of the wood block, which prints as black, and then the cutaway areas stay the color of the paper. Something you should pay attention to is that this printmaking method is different basically because the lines are so rough and the lines are so raw. Cutting into wood is not like an elegant, super refined process. It's definitely a process that kind of communicates like labor and hard work and kind of like a rough and a rawness. And there's almost like an energy to this. There's almost like a rough, vital energy that is kind of removed from fine art traditions. Like this really connects more to kind of like that primitive aspect of art, like a folk art, not a refined artistic process. So Kollwitz's career, like many German expressionists, she also used the woodblock print. Kirchner used the woodblock print. She didn't self-identify as a German expressionist. She was older than the German expressionists, but that's definitely the group that she kind of fits in stylistically. Her use of the woodblock print was a little bit uncharacteristic. She didn't paint. She only worked in woodblock print. And she created some of the most powerful and affecting work in this style. Her most famous artwork is the War Print Cycle of 1924, where she really embraced that raw, rough, vital energy of woodblock printing. And she created these pieces of artworks, like you've seen on some of these prior slides, that really have kind of like a haunting, very raw, emotional, evocative feeling that they project. So Kollwitz, you know, kind of in summation to kind of wrap up our conversations about her, she really felt that her artwork was the best way that she could protest against the terrors and the horrors of war. And as a mother who lost her son, using a woodblock print and really being that voice and showing those images of women and mothers and these children experiencing the horrors of war was very effectively communicated with the rough edges, the stark contrast between black and white that the woodblock prints were able to afford her.